another player comes to our hotel room and says, will you string these rackets for me? The answer is no. Period, no. If you want to sign a contract with us annually, sign here.
Hello and welcome to V for Visionaries podcast with me, Richard Ward. I am an award-winning serial entrepreneur with over 35 years experience in the beauty and media world. And I've built and sold many businesses. But today I'm most interested in finding out who are the movers and shakers in business, what makes them so successful, and why certain cream rises to the top.
And me, Rosamund Stenhouse. I am an award-winning fourth generation of entrepreneurs. I have spent several decades working with all aspects of land, delivering new towns and large-scale landmass for development. I now work with national and international entrepreneurs, scaling, improving sales, and expanding their business. This is the podcast where bold ideas meet business brilliance.
Yes, and each week we'll be sitting down with trailblazing entrepreneurs and industry leaders to uncover the strategies, the stories, and the secrets behind some of the world's most exciting business ventures.
Today, we welcome an incredible entrepreneur, Jay Schweid. He has scaled the heights of the tennis world. He's traveled in private jets. He's driven the fastest cars. He's stayed in the best hotels around the world, yet he has been homeless. He came back from all of this to become a multi-millionaire in the world of tech. Come and listen to this giant of a man, Jay Schweid.
What we normally do, Jay, is I'm sure you've heard this 1,000 times in all podcasts. Where did it all begin? I mean, were you born in New York? You know, what kind of parents did you come from? Did they have an entrepreneurial background? And why are you so driven, and how have you achieved what you have? So can you just take us back?
So yeah, I'm born and raised Jewish New Yorker. I was raised primarily by my father, who was fairly old for, you know, regular people as far as when he had me. He met my mom.
Was he from New York? Born in New York?
No. So my father was born, and that's why I'm saying the age part specifically. So he was born in Poland before the war and navigated the war. He was not the eldest, but kind of became the head of the family. His father had passed away, and then through various things, he became like the leader of the family and taking care of his mom and siblings, and little by little navigating through Europe. So he was born in Poland, raised in Germany, navigated through, got most of the family out. One brother they took, another passed away, and then stuff that happened. Families had it way worse. I mean, we're really lucky. So he little by little got family over. We had family here. You had to get sponsored. It was very complicated back then, whatever. So he got them over, and then he stayed in Paris for a couple of years. He started a business there. He got sidetracked. I mean, he was studying to be an engineer and a scientist. Like he was a pretty smart guy. But you know, then the war happened, so that was over. But he was smart, and he just knew stuff. He was into tech a little bit back then, and he built. I still have. It doesn't work. But I still have an actual, if you remember, or if you've seen them, most people don't remember. I don't remember it either. But the old radios, like we see them in old movies, like movies from the 40s and 50s. There was this like enormous radio like this big.
Yeah.
Oh, yes. Yes.
My father made one. I have like with tubes in the back, like none of them work anymore. But, you know, this beautiful piece of wood. That was the radio. I mean, you put a little S on the front for Schwab.
Wow.
Pretty funny, yeah. So that's what he did. And he worked like in a movie theater, and he just did stuff, not in the film business, like as an operator, like as the technical person. And then he came to the States. Then he eventually came here, and his sisters got married, and he came and made sure to take care of his mother and one of his elder brothers that was a little ill. And he
sounds like he never had a childhood, poor man.
Well, he spoke affectionately about what it was like. He used to tell me that, like, when he was a younger, like a teenager or whatever, they would go to parties, and the German kids could drink. Like, they would drink beer, and he knew he was little, he couldn't. So he would take coffee beans and he would like pop coffee beans so he could stay awake. And he was like, he would take one beer and make it last the whole night. And they were drinking 3, 4, 5 beers. And he was like sipping through and kept popping coffee beans so he would stay awake. So he was just always like the guy that everybody liked. Like he was just a nice guy. And then, you know, very wonderful to me. He was loving and kind and caring. He always, I say this to you, like every single day he told me that he loved me. Every single day. Without fail. Like this.
What a lovely way to talk about your father. How wonderful is that?
Oh, it was unbelievable. It was always a kiss. Always I love you. Like always. Even though I never felt that was good enough. Right, like I was always still, he was a tough, you know, he's still a tough guy, but he was still very compassionate with me. But, you know, like I was horrible in school. I mean, I couldn't stand school from the first day. I remember literally the first day kicking and screaming, get me out of here, get me out of here. First day, first grade, get me out of here. I don't want to be here. This is not for me. I knew it. And I just didn't do well at all. And the teachers luckily would be like, listen, you're way smarter than this. Like, we're not going to fail you. Like, this is ridiculous. Like, we know you're doing this on purpose. And one year, I was like, you know what? I'm going to go for it. I'm going to apply myself. Let's see what happens. And it was like middle of like early high school years or something like that. And I got like a 92 or something on a grade. Which was, for me, was amazing. I was getting like 30s and 40s. Like, I don't know if the grading system was there, but for us, it's like led to 100. So,
yep, same here.
You know, 65 was passing, and I was getting like 30s. Like, I was a horrible, horrible student. And I brought that home to my father. He was like, you couldn't get 100? Like, that was my father. So there was this like loving, sweet, hugging, kissing me. But there was always this like, you could do better. So it was
so many fathers are like that.
Interesting. Yeah, it was very, very interesting. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
So talk me through how your career started. So you leave school at what, 18?
No, 16 or so.
16. Okay, and what on earth did you do? What did you start to do? How did it all start?
So, you know, that word entrepreneurial, like everybody's an entrepreneur nowadays, you know, so I don't really, it's kind of silly. It's lost its value. But I was always into doing things. Like I always was into not necessarily making money per se, but I was always doing things. Like I was 12, like in New York, for example, you had to get a worker's permit if you wanted to work before you were 16 or 18, like to legally work. And I think it was like 12 years old, you could get a worker's permit. So you had to apply for it. I think the school had for it. I don't remember how you did it. 12 years old, I got my worker's permit. Like, I got that permit. I wanted to start working. I was like, I want to do something. This studying school, this is for somebody else, not for me. I wanted to work. I delivered groceries. I delivered dry cleaning. But so, I guess to the entrepreneurial part, so I delivered groceries, and then I worked inside the store and whatever. And then there was a better job delivering dry cleaning. What an idiot I was. So that was my genius. I was going to deliver dry cleaning. So if you ever delivered dry cleaning, let me tell you, in the winter in New York, it's not so much fun. And you kind of have to like hold the hangers on your, it's uncomfortable. And I was like, this doesn't make sense. Like this guy, how am I going to do this? I got to do all these deliveries. So I went to like my super who I was friendly with. And I was like, listen, I'm doing this delivery. I've got to figure out a better way so I can carry more stuff. And I was like, what if we take like a shopping cart and maybe you can build me like a rack and then I'll just take all the things and I'll do. Nobody did that. Everybody carried them by their hands and they walked back and forth and schlepped like. And so I built that. And then I went to the dry cleaner. I was like, I'm going to use it. They're like, what the hell is that?
Yeah, very sensible. And yes.
Like, so I always was like, if I see something and it's not working or if I see somebody that has a, I always want to do that better.
We think that's why you got into production and tech with that mindset.
Yeah, I think I'm always looking at things like I like putting pieces together and I see it before it's put together.
Because you're describing a visual and solving mind.
But tech came along a long time after you left school, right? So what were you doing before?
I left school. So the reason I left school, aside from that I couldn't stand it, was because I a few years into high school, I got bit by the tennis bug. Like I wanted to be a tennis player.
Nice.
And I remember watching a tennis match at the US Open, and I was like, I'm going to do this. And I really, I had no money. My father knew nothing about sports. I was like, I'm going to do this. And I dropped out of high school. I said, I can't practice after school and do homework, which I don't want to do, and have a part-time job to pay. This isn't going to work. And I was just like, well, if I can just get a job and play tennis, at least I'm cutting out the school part. And that was my pitch anyway. My father didn't like it, but whatever.
Don't worry, Richard and I both left school at 16 with the same mentality.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
Just so pressed it on.
I was like, whatever. So I did that. And then I was training. And then that was my goal. The goal was I was going to then be a professional tennis player. And so I, with a friend of mine that I was practicing with, we were starting to break strings because we got better and better. And we were breaking strings all the time. I was like, this is expensive. And there was some very cheap stringing machine that we bought together. And I taught myself how to string rackets. I started running around town working with local shops. And back to the Jewish thing just for a second. So there was a tennis club in town that there were no Jews, no blacks allowed. And so
Really? What year was this?
Maybe late 70s, 80s. Like, Jimmy Connors was playing at that time.
Right. Okay. Late 70s, yeah. Borg era.
So 70s, 80s. Yeah, that era, roughly. Yeah. So I was a child, I was a kid. So I couldn't go to this tennis club, but that's where the US Open was before they moved it to where it is now. And so I couldn't play there at all. But during the tournament, the public was allowed. And I had already gotten known a little bit as being a really good racket technician. I started. Now that I had a good machine, I started playing around with things. And that whole thing about, you know, well, if something is fine, I'll leave it alone. And I was looking at how rackets were being strung. I was like, this doesn't make any sense. I don't understand it. Like, I'm doing it, but like the outer strings are getting loose. I don't know if you guys know tennis, but like it didn't make sense to me. So I kept playing around, and I came up with this new technique that no one had done before.
Wow.
And my rackets started playing better. Like, I gave them to local good players. Like, you know, one of my clients was ranked 80 in the world. He lived in New York. I was like, I don't know what you did to my racket, but it's never played that great before, ever. Yeah. So I was like, well, maybe I'm onto something. But I still was like, I was determined to be a pro player. I was doing this was a side hustle. Like, this was a way to get me on tour. Like, the goal was to get on tour.
I think you love that.
But during that time, apparently Jimmy Connors heard about me. And when he came to New York for that tournament, he told the guys at the pro shop, he's like, I'm looking for this guy, Jay Schweid. Like, I need him to string my rackets. And they were so pissed.
You're probably running in the other direction.
They were so pissed because they thought they were the shit, and they weren't. And so I had to go there and whatever. So that kind of started to propel me into that world. And I was still looking to play tournaments. I was playing local tournaments. I was doing pretty well, but I needed to get on tour. And some friends of mine was like, you should go to the French Open. And I was like, what am I going to do at the French Open? Like, what's... I've never been to Paris. I mean, it doesn't make any sense. They're like, listen, that's where the players are going to be. And I was working at a different club now, like a really a high-end club in the city. And they were like, let's go. If you go, we'll go with you. Like, let's go to Paris. All the players will be there. Somehow through somebody at the club who I knew, I was just starting telling me, like, I'm going to the French Open. And I was like, but there was this one at the time, there was this one main player hotel. It's still changed. And it was very strict. So, like, if you're a player or you were a coach, you got there. Otherwise, they kept it on lock. Like, you couldn't get in. There was a very special way to get in to stay in this hotel. And I had to stay there. There was no way around it. So through one of the guys at the club, he was good friends with a guy who I had met named Bobby Shriver. As in the Shriver family, as in the Kennedy family.
Ah, sorry. Yes, I did think I know
father
that.
Father used to be like the ambassador to France.
Wow.
Who made a phone call. And all of a sudden, I had a room in this hotel. And I was, oh, wow. I was like, holy, like, okay, so that's how it works. Like, that is how it works. So I stayed at this player hotel. And all of a sudden, all these players were like, oh, I heard you're here. Can you take a look at my rackets? And I just started working with all these players, like one after the
other. That's incredible, Jay.
And it was just like this tiny little hotel room in France with my two buddies. And it was great. And then it just took off. Then I went to Wimbledon. And
Do you know what that occurred to me, though, weirdly? It occurred to me about 10 minutes ago as you were talking about stringing rackets and you're becoming better and better and you're becoming known and you're getting, and all the top players want you to string their rackets. But actually, they're all in competition with each other. So I'm thinking, so if I'm Jimmy Connors and I'm getting Jay Schwein to string my racket, well, I don't want him stringing Beyond Borg's bloody racket. I was just thinking, that must, you know, actually, because that could almost backfire on you in a way.
So, and it's funny you say that, because when I was doing this and I was known in the industry and they would do it, I did interviews here and there and HBO would come to our house at Wimbledon and all this kind of stuff. Reporters inadvertently would always ask that question, like, well, did anybody ever pay you to like screw up so-and-so's right?
Handshake.
I do my part. You know, I do the best work I do, whether it's, you know, Agassi or Sampras or whoever I'm doing, I'm giving that person the best work for that person. So I met Agassi when he was 15, when he was nobody. Nobody knew who he was. I met him then. And it's where I ran into my first anti-Semitism in business situation, where he promised that he was going to work with me once he signed the contract. And the manager was, let's say, not a fan of us. And he ends up working with that other guy. And as it goes on, he signs this contract. I'm like, and I warned them. I warned him and I warned Scott. I was like, listen, at the rate you guys are going, at the way he's playing, at the way he's getting stronger, and the way you're taking care of his rackets, he is going to hurt himself. He is going to get hurt. I'm telling you, I'm warning you. I have nothing to gain by saying this. He is going to get hurt. And sure enough, he got hurt and he had to have wrist surgery and he was off tour for a while. And then his dad called me and he was like, I need your help. He's coming back. I was like, okay. And we built from nothing all the way up.
It's interesting that you said there was the contract with Agassi. There was a contract on the table to sign.
Yeah.
I mean, I never thought in a million years that tennis players have a contract with someone to string their rackets.
So the guy before me started it in a slightly different way. It was a weird situation. So this is the positives and the negatives. I saw it from a business perspective, right? So I understood what we were doing as a service, but I was like, okay, but there's got to be a business part here. So we would sign contracts with our players based on certain criteria, and it would be an annual contract. And I would look at, there's a certain amount of work, and we would charge them basically a retainer. And then we would provide the service, and when they use up the retainer, they would renew the retainer, and that was it. But we signed a contract for the year. Like, you're committed to us, and we're committed to you. I'm going to make sure I have enough staff. I'm going to make sure this, whatever. And then we would go to the major tournaments as well and be there. So the customizing work we had to do in our office, because it's big equipment and it's chemical materials and all this sort of stuff. But the stringing and the gripping rackets and doing tweaks and stuff we could do on the road. So we would come to a tournament, we would bring their rackets, we would ship their rackets there, we would be there, we'd get a hotel suite or a room, and we would work like maniacs, like, you know, for days on end, and that's what we did. So, but when I went to those tournaments, I was very clear with other players and with the tournaments that I was like, listen, I'm here to service my clients. So I'm not competing with the official service. I'm not doing that. Like, I'm being very clear. We have 35 players in this tournament. We have 65 players in this tournament. Here's the list. I was very transparent about it. We only work with them. If another player comes to our hotel room and says, will you string these 3, 4, 5 rackets for me? The answer is no. Like, no. Like, period, no. If you want to sign a contract with us annually, I'll give you a contract right now. You can read it. If you like it, you sign it. We'll start working.
Jay, I know we've moved on. Let's just talk about 2024. You've got a racket, 2024. What does it cost to string a professional racket? If you just took one racket, what does it cost?
I honestly can't say because I've been out of the business for so long, but I would say when we were the official racket service of the US Open, and when that contract ended, I still stayed on and took care of a few players for maybe about a year or so. And then I passed the business on to my partner. I was like, I'm done. I'm moving on. I can't do this anymore. I didn't want to do it anymore. We were charging, I think, $25 per racket just for stringing. Just for stringing.
That's so cheap, $25.
The rackets is one of the things that is the only thing they pay for, really, like on an upfront basis. So we would charge like $250 per racket to customize. So that was more of like where the bulk of the money.
Would you say hard work? Because people listening might think, well, he's just been lucky. He bumped into this person, that person. Yeah, but that's not true.
No, you
worked your behind off.
No, so I'll tell you, one of my clients told me this. It's interesting. Luck is an interesting word. So one of my clients was a top doubles player, but a decent singles player, but not a top singles player. And you'll get this. And he was playing a match at Wimbledon. And so we had it on TV and we watched the match. I'm watching. And at some point, the ball, he's playing and the ball hits the net just as he's approaching. Like, if it wouldn't hit the net, it would have been a passing shot. But it hits the net. He's right there. He hits a winner. And it turned the match. And I said to him when he came by after the match, I was like, wow, it was a great match. I was like, you really got lucky at that point. He was like, that wasn't luck. I was like, what are you talking about? It hit the net. Of course it was. I said, no. He's like, Jay, did you watch the match or you not watch the match? I was like, yeah, I watched it. He's like, did you see how I was doing this and this? I was like, yeah, okay, got it. So he was explaining there's a strategy that he was doing. So he might not have been that point, but at some point he was breaking the guy down. And it just so happened he did that. And that, yes, that took it. But it wasn't luck. It was the hard work that he was doing that created that luck. Now people say that, and there's different versions of what all these super consultants say and the famous influencers say that. Whatever. Hard work brings luck. It does.
You've also got to have a certain amount of balls. I mean, you've got to have, you know, there's balls behind humility. I mean, humility is not a grovel. There's humility is actually having the courage and the balls to put your hand out and say, I'm looking for this. Would you be interested in my name is?
Yeah. And I think you have to also approach things with a level of humility. I mean, I think you have to look at it like, you know, there has to be a benefit to everybody. It can't just be like, hey, hire me. Like, hey, give me money. Like, that doesn't work. Like, I think I can add value to your life. I think I can add value to what you're doing. So if I can do that for you, well, it's only reasonable that I should get compensation for that. Like, of course, you're going to compensate me for that. That's logical. So it becomes more symbiotic. Like, it fits. It makes sense. So it has to. Otherwise, it gets negative.
Yeah.
So just moving on, Jay. So CEO of Effluence. It's production and tech. So
production marketing.
Just in layman's terms, tell our listeners and viewers what exactly that entails.
So we evolved. Like when we first started, there was no business model, there was no idea. It was just something I knew I needed to do something after the tennis days.
Yeah.
I had the racket company, I had the travel service, I had the concierge service. I ended all of those and I had to start something new. And the consensus from people that I knew were like something in entertainment, hospitality areas, those worlds are where I'd be best. I was like, okay, fine. So I said, I guess production, I'll try that. I was doing events already. When I had the concierge, I started doing events all over. I did events in London, Paris, and Australia, like Miami. So I already knew that. I was like, oh, well, I'll do event production. That's up my alley. I'll do it maybe a little bit bigger, a little bit different, but I'll start that. And when I started doing that, little by little, people were coming to me with other things. So I already knew actors and producers and directors and all that sort of stuff, but I wasn't like in the world per se. Like I'd been to a film set because a friend of mine was an actor and he was like, oh, come to set. It'll be fun. And I didn't know when I would watch and I saw them rehearse and I would watch how they shot, but I wasn't interested. It wasn't what I was doing at the time. And so little by little from events, we got asked to do videos and I didn't necessarily know what to do, but I was like, oh, well, I know somebody who's a director and I think he has a cinematographer and then maybe one of them knows an editor and I don't know, we'll figure it out. Like, or just seems logical. So
can I say something? Because what you're describing is it's like in Ireland, you know, there's the Irish sort of have every single job going, every single company going, they have multiple companies. It's the same as the old, you know, London East End, you know, all the boys had multiple different deals going, multiple different, it's incredible. I mean, you've just described prior to where you're going now, I mean, a large amount of different irons in the fire.
Yeah.
How is your mind able to process all that? Do you sleep? How do you do that, Jay?
I like to be productive, but I don't like have to do something, right? Like I'm not that. Like I don't like, oh, I'm sitting still. Oh my God, you know. But if I'm doing something, I'm doing it. If I'm going to do it, I'm going to do it. You know, if I'm, but if I see something, look, I see opportunities all the time, right? And so I walk down the street, I was like, oh, we better, I'm like, okay, but that's not you. Like, that's not your, I'm curious. I'm always curious.
But tech-wise, what are you actually producing? I mean, without obviously giving customer names, but what do you, give me a really juicy job that you might come in for you that might really excite you.
So we're developing a platform that will take projects from concept to distribution all on one platform, engaging creatives, fans, and investors.
How are you choosing who gets on and who doesn't? Or is it just a free-for-all?
It's a membership. So it's a membership. People join as a member. They then connect as they would connect. So the idea is that you can, if you're in the industry, you connect within the industry. You can have your own little groups. You can have cinematographers can have their own group like they do on Facebook or on LinkedIn. Or they can connect with other things. They can learn. They can collaborate, all that sort of stuff. If you have a project, there's systems built in that you could take the project all the way through, from submission all the way through. So you don't have to do it like yourself. But if you're just there and you're like, I want to do it myself, but I just want to be in the community, that's okay too. But there's fans also. So fans can do the same thing. Fans can interact with each other. So everybody wins, because the costume designer all of a sudden now has fans. When they have fans, they're more likely to get hired for better jobs. It's a logical place to bring people
together.
Yeah,
it's a much easier place to obtain and raise funds sometimes too.
How much does it cost to put something like that together? I mean, the time and all the people that it must do. It must do. But, you know, I was saying to somebody...
But it's worth it.
Of course. Yes. And it's a brilliant idea. I was saying to somebody the other day... We talked to so many people. I can't actually remember quite who it was. But anyway, he was designed something and he'd invented something. And I was just saying, that just seems so obvious to me. Why haven't I thought of that? You know, yeah. I mean, and the simple things. And it's just something. And you're thinking, my God, that world so needs that.
It does.
It's all about building with a positive ethos. Like there's a core... Yes, this platform is going to make a ridiculous amount of money, and the investors are going to be very happy that they got behind.
Yeah, I agree. I think
it's no questions. That's not why we're doing it. That's not why we're doing it. We're doing this to help people around the world. We're doing this to have a global impact.
I'm sure that's true, but you invest. Come on, you investors want to make money, don't they? Surely
they are going to make money, but I'm not doing it just for the money.
You're not driven by money at all.
I like money. I like nice things. Don't get me wrong. I'm blessed. I've stayed at some of the nicest hotels in the world.
Yeah.
I've driven in some of the nicest cars in the world.
Yeah.
I've been in private jets.
Yeah.
I like it. Don't get me wrong. I like it. I've been this close to being homeless. I've literally been.
Have you really?
Where am I sleeping tonight?
Have you really?
So. I know what it's like to have absolutely nothing.
Yeah. Am I surprised?
Yeah, why are you surprised?
Well, because Jay says...
Because he's starting from nothing over and over and over. That tech comes with huge risk. And you will have to go balls to the wall and risk homelessness and possibly go homeless for a night to achieve that.
Well, I don't think that we've spoken to anyone on any of our pods that have told us that they've been that close to being homeless.
I've always thought they've been
homeless. Maybe they haven't been so candid as you.
No,
I'll be totally honest. I'm telling you, true story. I was sitting at a storage unit. I was sitting there and I was like, okay, where am I going to sleep tonight? Like, and I was thinking, and then a friend of mine called me and he's like, I'm going to give you money to stay in a hotel tonight. Like, I'm going to go get some lunch, go get some dinner. I'm literally looking like, oh, if I could stay at this diner, I could stay there maybe for a couple hours and then they'll kick me out. And then I'll go to this diner, I'll stay there for a couple hours. And
let me ask something. We've got about 5 to 10 minutes left, Jay, but I want to ask one last question before Richard wraps it up. Is with all this, taking into account the trauma that your father must have experienced growing up is just mind-blowing. That had to have had an impact on you and in a positive way that has created this restless, insatiable mind that just keeps going, that is you. How do you deal with everything that goes on in your mind? Because you really are, you know, I do believe there's different types of entrepreneurs. You definitely are one that is of the, you know, the sort of brighter minds that is the sort of intricate details. How do you come down from that every day?
I bet he doesn't. I bet your mind's just constant. Your mind's a bit like, they call me the labyrinth because my mind never stops as well.
Yeah, never stops.
My mind doesn't stop. I'm active when I'm asleep, but I'm very empathetic. I read the room and I always think about everybody else before I think about myself.
Do you know, we could go on for so bloody long, but I've got to ask you, I'm going to probably completely ruin this whole podcast by asking you the most obvious bloody question that you're probably sick to death of asking. And inside you think, oh, Richard G. Pratt, I really quite liked you until you asked me this question. What's with the hair? How long is it? This is your trademark, right?
So herein lieth the problem. Like, I, not that I want to cut it, but I kind of almost can't. It's not an option. It wasn't by design. And it's funny because I really didn't think about it at all. Like, I just didn't at all. And then when I was in the tennis world, I was going to Paris and Wimbledon every year. So I had a lot of friends in Paris and I was involved in the nightlife scene. So I was going out all the time. And I hadn't been in probably 5 or 6 years. And then a friend of mine got married and I went there. And I went to take his brother. I was messaging with a friend of mine. I was like, oh, I want to come to your club. And he's like, please come, please, please. I was like, I'm going to bring his friend. Great. We get out of the car a half a block away from the club. Just as my friend, who's the owner of the club, is walking to the club. And he was like, Jay. And he spotted me he's like, I saw that hair. I knew it was you. And I was like, okay. I guess that's it.
So listen, Greg, I just had to ask you that, but you know, bit of a boring question, obvious one, but I had to ask you. It's only because I'm jealous. Right, just so we have three questions before we wrap up that we ask all of our guests. Well, the first question is, if you're prime minister, that we call it prime minister. Okay, so president. All right, so you've got president for the day. What's the first thing you change?
Oh wow. That's a big one. Getting people to talk and listen to each other. If I had the power, like, yeah, that's it. Like, you're going to have to listen and you're going to have to shut up when someone else is talking. Because all the other stuff is so easy to fix. Like, give me a break. But it's not complicated. Having an immigration system is not complicated. Yeah. Getting the economy to make sense is not complicated. It's just work it out. If you don't talk to each other, you're going to argue about the most stupidest of stupid things, then nothing is going to get done. And something will get done just to get it done, as opposed to, I just read last night, I was like, of course, like, there's some budget thing they're trying to figure out. The guy proposed something and they purposely said no, with no real logic. And he's like, you know what? I gave it a shot. Now I'm going to go with a plan that I knew was going to work anyway. Really?
No.
Like, that really? That okay, was your
I've
strategy?
Got a better question for you. I've got a better okay. one. And I'm going to guess, but I'm not going to tell you what I'm going to guess. But when you were growing up, did you have a favorite music star, whether it was rock, heavy metal, pop? Was there an individual that you just thought was the coolest of the bunch?
Yeah, honestly, I feel music. I don't just hear it, I feel it.
Okay.
So I've had a variety of people that I've loved over the years. I mean, I listened to Mary J. Blige and I cry.
Yeah.
Like, and I was very heavy into dance music.
Okay.
Like, very, very heavy into dance music.
Okay, last question. As because of the tennis, your tennis connections is, what's your favorite sport? Are you a sports fanatic?
I used to be more fanatic. I over the years, that my time gets off. I go, shit, I missed the game, and I just kind of stop. So American football is certainly my favorite.
Is it? Do you know, I've got into that by watching that quarterback on Netflix.
People don't understand. It's such an intelligent, complex.
Oh yes, you can see that.
If you don't know it, you just think, oh, these big guys beating each other.
We lived in California. We're living in Silicon Valley. We used to go to 49ers games a lot.
49ers games,
great.
Yeah.
So Jay, listen, it has been an absolute joy. And oh my God, what you've just told us, what you've got coming around the corner, what you're working on, is going to be absolutely life-changing. And such an inspirational story. I mean, especially from your story, from your parents, what you've been through, coming to America, not going to college. It's everything that I understand. And, you know, you've been an absolute inspiration to both of us. And I know that everyone listening and watching will be exactly the same.
Thank you
so much.
Great. All right. Have a wonderful night. Thank you so much.
Bye.
Bye.